religious opposition to the teaching of science is as old as science itself. Intelligent design creationism is only its newest guise. Our guest today is Jeannie Scott, the executive director of the National Center for Science Education and one of the heroes of the fight to keep science education in our schools. Also joining us this morning in the studio is Greg Layden, a scientific advisor to the Minnesota Citizens for Science Education and a longtime resident of the trenches. Rounding out today's discussion is Lynn Fellman, Minneapolis artist and passionate champion of science education. Jeannie, Greg, and Lynn, welcome to Atheists Talk.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Nice to be here.
Hi, Jeannie. Hi, Greg. Thank you for joining us on a beautiful spring day.
Good morning.
I met Jeannie when she was in town to speak at the Innovation 2008 conference at the U of M last October. And since then, we've kicked off a really big year for evolution and science. And Jeannie is right on top of it with speaking engagements all over the country. So when she was in Minneapolis last fall, I thought she may like to relax with some of the science educators we have here in town for some informal conversation. So, August Berkshire and members of the Minnesota Citizens for Science Education got together at my studio. And Greg was there, and we had such a good talk, I wanted us to get together again. Plus, a new edition of Jeannie's book, Evolution versus Creationism, is out, so I thought the timing was just right. So thanks, Jeannie, for talking to us. Before we get to the issues and your book, let's just start off with understanding what the center does. What's your role in it, and how did you get there?
The National Center for Science Education grew out of a fairly informal group of scientists and teachers back in the late 70s and early 80s who were very concerned about legislation cropping up all over the country that would require that if teachers taught evolution, they'd have to teach something called creation science, which was an effort to take biblical literalism and support it with scientific data and theory. And, of course, that's rather unsuccessful. But the bills were not so unsuccessful. They were submitted all over the country, fortunately, most of them died in committee. Two of them actually did get passed, and we can talk about that. But scientists and teachers clearly did not want to see these bills get implemented. And so they banded together in states around the country to try to figure out what is this creation science stuff, and how can you oppose these efforts to get this legislation passed. Scientists and teachers tend not to be particularly good at politics, which of course is what this issue is all about. And so there was something of a learning curve for most of us involved in this issue back then. The a couple of the national science organizations like AIBS and the National Science the National Association of Biology Teachers tried to bring together some of these individuals around the country to coordinate and communicate with each other. And the president of NABT started referring to this movement as the Committees of Correspondence, taking the term, of course, from the Revolutionary War Committees. And these were statewide groups that corresponded with each other, so to speak, about the efforts of creationists to affect the teaching of science in their schools. And the Committees of Correspondence then, in the early 80s, gave rise to NCSC because it became clear that this was not a movement that was going to go away too quickly. And the idea of having a national organization that would try to coordinate some of these local efforts be the repository, so to speak, of information to pass on to new groups grew up, and that's pretty much how NCSC got started.
Okay.
I was hired in the late 80s as the first executive director.
Okay, so that takes us back quite a ways. Thanks for explaining that. I understand better now how things evolved with getting some good information in place in an organization like that. Now, you were a college professor, and your area was physical anthropology. Greg Layden is a biological anthropologist. So could you tell
me...
Same thing,
just different terms.
Oh, yeah, and please maybe talk together, too, about how you can make that move from being, you know, in the classroom, in the college, to this kind of thing. I'd love to hear about that.
Well, I'll just jump in and say I'm not sure how relevant it is, but it is true that biological anthropology is probably the subfield of biology that deals with the issues that people who are not in favor of teaching evolution might get more upset about, because it includes the field of human evolution, although it's not the only place human evolution is done. But and there might be another angle as well, and that is, if you're an anthropologist, you can't really be a biological anthropologist without being trained more broadly as an anthropologist. And that might help as well, because it might give you some insight into human nature that a bench scientist may have missed because they spent their entire developmental period in a lab, and you know, they get a little weird when they get out of the lab. So it might be that, you know, an anthropologist has a little training in cultural relativism and understanding language and linguistics, and maybe more social science trained and oriented, and a little bit better to do the kind of things that Jeannie does.
Well, yeah. I've thought about this a little bit, because the question has come up before about, you know, well, has your anthropological background had anything to do with your ability to how NCSE is run? And I think that's part of it too. I mean, the fact that I am an anthropologist, and I do have this more, as Greg was describing, we use the term holistic, which has unfortunately acquired something of a new age term about it these days, but that's not quite what I mean. Looking at a problem from all directions is really what I mean. That's very typical of how anthropologists go about examining things. And I think that tendency to sort of stand back and try to look at all of the factors that are involved in the situation typifies how anthropologists go about things, and it's been absolutely essential for my work at NCSE. When you think about it, there's so many different threads and so many different stakeholders in this controversy. If you just focus on the science, you're not going to succeed. The science is absolutely essential, but it's not sufficient. I learned this actually when I was a college professor in Lexington, Kentucky, years ago, and I experienced my first what we call here at NCSE these days flare-up, the incident in Lexington where the Citizens for Balanced Teaching of Origins, I love the names of these groups, came to the Lexington Board of Education with a suggestion in 1980 that they teach creation science. And gee, wow, Lexington would be on the cutting edge of science education. Wouldn't this be great? Scientists from California would come out and train our teachers. It was great. And of course, the faculty, the science faculty up on campus, thought this is a terrible idea. And we organized to try to oppose this. Well, we found that the teachers in the community also were very concerned about this, and so teachers and scientists working together was sort of a natural alliance. But then we found that it was extremely important in Lexington that the mainstream clergy be involved, because it was very easy to paint this issue of should creationism be taught in schools as a science versus religion issue. And of course, it isn't science versus religion. It's, you know, are you going to teach good science or not? And in the case of creation science, it's perfectly awful science, even setting aside the church-state separation issues, which are also important. But once the mainstream clergy in town discovered that what was being proposed by the Citizens for Balanced Teaching of Origin was teaching biblical literalism as truth, as science, as factually verified, they came over to our side. And we found that having this coalition of scientists, teachers, and clergy, and civil libertarians, of course, was extremely powerful. And working together, all four of these arguments, so to speak, eventually were persuasive in persuading the Lexington School Board not to pass the policy. And that's basically the same coalition that we have used since at NCSE when we're trying to help communities or states to deal with this problem. We encourage them to approach the issue from the broadest possible direction. Get scientists, get teachers, get clergy, get civil libertarians, get business people if you can possibly get them. They're the hardest ones to get. But try to bring as many components of the society together to deal with this issue. And I think that's a very anthropological approach.
That's a wonderful explanation. So one thing that when Greg and I were talking earlier, he said that you are so clear on the issues and you communicate it so well. But just as you said, it's not just science that you're trying to communicate the understanding of how it works. It's working with the cultural issues in our society.
Well, certainly science is very, very important. If you don't have the science, then you don't have an argument at all. But the good news is we have the science. I mean, the science is very, very clear on the side of evolution. And we need to make people more aware of that. My argument is that the science is necessary but not sufficient. The reason why people reject evolution, trust me on this one, is not because the science is poor. The reason why people reject evolution is for emotional and religious reasons that have very little to do with the strength of the scientific issues. So you have to deal with this from a broad perspective, from a more holistic perspective, if you're going to be successful.
Jeannie, we have a question that came in by email that's related to what you've been talking about with the different interested parties. This is a question from Carl. It says, since the NCSE is for the education of science and reason, would it not be better to be more like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, etc., when it comes to getting the message out, instead of playing nice to creationists who want to put their religion in the science classes?
Well, I don't know that we're playing nice to creationists who want to get their religion into science classes. That's not what we're doing at all. We oppose bad science. We oppose creationism in the science classes. I don't know where he gets that idea. We do, however, cooperate with allies. And we find that members of mainstream clergy, Catholics and mainstream Protestants, are allies. They don't want to have creationism taught in the public schools either. They'd rather teach creationism their own way on the weekends. And so I'm perfectly happy to cooperate with people who share my goals. I think there's a confusion out there, though, in the blogosphere and elsewhere, that NCSE, because it supports evolution and opposes creationism, is therefore an atheist or humanist organization, and it's not. It's it doesn't take a stand on religious views. I mean, on my staff, on my board, on members of NCSE, we have everything from evangelical Christians to atheists. It'd be very difficult for us to pick a religious position or non-religious position to support, given that kind of diversity. So we're not our goals are not to promote disbelief. I mean, you know, people who criticize us for dissing religion just apparently don't understand that. Our goals are to help people understand evolution and hopefully accept it, and help people understand that science is a really, really good and effective way of understanding the natural world. And if your goals are to promote atheism, fine, go ahead and do that, but that's not our goal. And at least in the United States, you cannot maximize for the number of people who accept evolution and the number of people who become atheists. And I know what my goals are.
Can I jump in?
Yeah, your email correspondent just is not very well informed, I think.
Can I jump in on that, too? I think there is an important difference to be understood between an approach where you have many different people sitting at the table to talk about a policy or an approach to doing something like teaching science versus having many different opinions at the table about the science itself. So a good analogy that takes some of the politics out of it is imagine a major road project with a bridge and some overpasses and so on, and everyone is at the table. Business people, citizens are all at the table because it impacts them and they have some influence. But the citizens are not welcome necessarily to suggest specific engineering principles that they think might work. You still do good engineering when you build a bridge and good practices for construction and so on. And the accounting processes and all the other things that have to do with the public works are done using best practices, even though everyone's at the table. I think that's a reasonable analogy for how this works. Another thing I just want to throw in, and that is, it isn't just the case that people think that NCSE might be atheistic. There's also people who are in the atheist community who think NCSE might think NCSE is too much of an appeasing organization with respect to religion. And I think that's where that's the tenor I got from this call, this particular remark. And I think that that's also not true. I think that when it comes down to it, when I've been in the same room with people on the far far ends of the spectrum, as Jeannie has as well. And my view is that when people sit down to talk about what to do in school districts, no one's arguing about the role of religion versus science and so on. We're just dealing with the practical, pragmatic considerations of what has to happen and what the law says and how to help teachers do what they need to do and so on. And these discussions that are on the blogosphere don't happen in the committees and in the day-to-day conversations among people interested in science education.
And we also have a phone call. This is from Scott, who is a high school teacher. Scott, please go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much, and thank you, Dr. Scott, for all the work you do. I was fortunate enough to tour your facility about this time last year. I happened to be in the same party that included P.Z. Myers, and we kind of truckled in together.
Oh, hi. How are you?
That word truckling, of course, I'm referring to Dr. Cohen's article, on the which kind of discarded a recent discussion of this topic about, you know, whether or not NCSC is supposedly truckling to, for lack of a better word, people called accommodationist. Well, I have an interesting perspective. My perspective is I'm a high school classroom teacher. I teach science. I'm a member of NSCA, and I'm also a theist. And I too am concerned that there's a possibility that that in its public pronouncements that NCSC may be giving the impression that a full diversity of views with respect to evolution is not welcome. I don't believe that's the case, but I believe that there could probably be some fine-tuning that could take place in how NCSC interacts with the entire community, kind of nip that in the bud, because I don't think it's productive for people to be pointing fingers at each other. In fact, I'll get off in a moment, but I just wanted to say I read Bruce Chapman's commentary on the Texas board hearings, and he was clearly alluding to the fact that there is division amongst the ranks of NCSE, and oh, wouldn't it be fun to watch the Darwinists fall all over themselves? So, but I am concerned. I do think that perhaps we could do a bit better job of parsing out these distinctions and making sure that it's clear that no particular point of view is privileged.
Thank you, Scott. And Jeannie, we've got just a couple of minutes before we go to commercial.
There's a number of things involved. NCSC does not promote atheism. We have no objection to people promoting atheism or promoting religion. I mean, that's freedom of speech. And if I'm a fundamentalist about anything, I'm a fundamentalist about freedom of speech. We have goals that are limited, and I explained them a moment ago. In order to achieve those goals, we need to have the widest possible coalition, which means cooperating with theists and religious people who share our goals. For that, we've been criticized, and I don't quite understand why. It just seems like Greg was saying earlier, it's very practical politics. If there is the misunderstanding that by doing so, we therefore are criticizing the hardline, as they call themselves, new atheists, well, they just need to listen more carefully. When people ask me, as they often do, at the end of a talk, well, is Dawkins hurting the cause? I say pretty much what I've said here. He has different goals than I have, and I don't put him down, and I'd appreciate it if NCSC were not put down also.
Thanks, Jeannie. You know, when we talk about education, we talk about standards here, and that's something that we're looking at in Minnesota sort of on an ongoing basis. And our situation in Minnesota is very different in Texas, and it's an interesting contrast. Can you just say a few things that will lead us into a discussion in just a few minutes?
Well, science education standards are very important because they provide a guide for teachers as to what they should include in their instruction.
Greg is really up to date on that and has some insights. Greg, why don't you just take it away with your ideas and thoughts?
Well, I'd like to hear Jeannie finish her thoughts on standards, but I thought we could couch it somewhat in a question, which is where do we want to see these decisions being made about things like standards and curriculum, which are not the same thing. And Minnesota is in a somewhat unusual circumstance because we have in this state over 400 school boards. We have 400 districts, or 400 and something districts. About a third of the people in this state live in three of those districts, which leaves everyone else living in a very large number. So the average number of, except for the big three districts, the average number of citizens represented in a by a school board in the state that hires a superintendent to run a school district consisting of one high school and a handful of other schools is about 8,000 people. So, and that's a decision at which curriculum is, the level at which curriculum is decided and a lot of, and all the school policies are decided. But, and at the state level, we have a set of state standards, which I think is kind of normal to have state standards. So the difference between, the difference in hierarchy of the citizenry between the standards and the districts is just enormous, as opposed to, I think, some other states where there are fewer districts, larger districts, and more people involved in those. I guess I want to ask Jeannie what you think about local control versus statewide control versus national control. Should there be national standards? Are state standards better? Or are state standards bad? You know, what do you think about those things?
Well, it isn't either or situation. There are some advantages of local control, but I don't think curriculum is one of them. I don't think that it makes sense to have the kind of patchwork curriculum that we have in this country, where students in one school district would be learning, you know, long division in 1 year, and students in the next district over will be learning it in another. If you move districts, you may never learn how to do long division. a fourth grader is a fourth grader. I mean, there's a certain curriculum that would be appropriate. You don't really need to tailor the curriculum in the fashion that it tends to be. And what this ends up, start at the beginning. Because we have such a decentralized school system, and it's not just Minnesota, this is the case all over the country, because we have a decentralized education system, we have a very politicized education system. And politicization of curriculum in particular is very disadvantageous, I think, to American education. When we have people deciding in this community, yes, we'll teach evolution, in this community, no, we won't teach evolution, that doesn't help science literacy in this country.
Do you think that you're ready for the fight for national standards?
We have national standards, but they're only advisory. And what was interesting about the National Science Standards is that they were drawn up through a very lengthy period of critique and consensus, bringing in people from all over the country, so that when the national standards were finally published back in the, 94 or something like that, they tended to be taken and cloned by the people in the states who were responsible for their state standards, because the people in the states had input in the national standards. So the National Science Education Standards and the benchmarks for science literacy from AAAS tended to be very important in shaping the science standards around the country. But still, having advisory national standards versus mandatory national standards is a huge step. I think it would be very unlikely, frankly, to get to that point. Just because American culture and American traditional is so decentralized when it comes to education. I mean, we really worship local control of education. And people, I don't know, there's something about the idea of national standards that gets people's backs up. So I think it would be a very tough fight to get that done.
It almost seems a bit ironic that the kind of worshiping of local standard, local control, which I think is very true, it also is a sort of libertarian idea. And I tend to connect that with the kind of politics and culture you see in places like Texas, which has this one whopping big school board that seems to have more...
No. You have one state board of education, and then you have a zillion small local districts, just like you have in Texas and Minnesota.
But don't they make more... The kind of decisions that were being talked about when you were in Texas a few weeks ago are the kind of decisions that are not so much discussed here. It seems to me that I might be wrong about this, but it seems to me that I guess this is my original question, is it seems to vary across the country where decisions are made and how detailed they're made in the run from basic standards to more detailed standards to curriculum.
There's a lot of variation from state to state in how mandatory the state standards are. And it basically has to do with the purse strings. If the state ties state contribution to local school district education to adoption and implementation of the standards, then the standards have a lot more clout. If the standards are just advisory, then they don't have. But what's changed in the last 4 or 5 years really has been a product of No Child Left Behind. which, you know, teachers refer to as No Child Left Untested, the testing provisions for NCLB have made the standards much more important. Because if you have to have regular tests of students to judge their progress, what are you going to base those tests on? Well, obviously, you have to base them on the standards. So the standards become very, very important from a statewide level. And so there's a lot more pressure from the state departments or state boards of education to lean on the local districts to implement those state standards so that the overall state scores are going to go up. And there's various carrots and sticks that have been implemented in doing that. It is kind of ironic, though, isn't it, that the passion for testing that came out of NCLB has actually resulted in more standardization of curriculum and, in one sense, less local control.
Mm-hmm.
And the irony of that, of course, is that this came in under a Republican administration.
From Texas.
Which tends to really favor local control.
Now, Jeannie, we're having this show at a very interesting time, considering that Minnesota just put out science standards on Friday, I believe. So our switchboard is lighting up and our email is coming in, and I am going to take a call from Dana in Roseville. Dana, go ahead.
Hi, Greg, Jeannie. I actually was involved with the science standards, and I talked to Jeannie. We actually met at Innovation 8 about the standards, and I was actually just wondering if either of you had had a chance to look over the standards and just get what your thoughts were on our standards.
Well, thanks. Yeah, thanks for calling. I'm more interested in your opinion than my opinion on these standards because you've worked with them more. I looked at them, but I haven't read them. I've cheated. I did a search for the word evolution to see where it was, and I read those parts, and I liked everything I saw, but what I don't know is what parts of the standards were, that's not where you have to look. I know that there was there were one or two, Dana, part components of those standards that were pre-declared to be unchangeable by your committee. Can you tell us what those parts were? Oh, he's not online anymore. Okay, that was an issue. There was some potentially pro-creationist language in those standards that were put in, and we were told that they couldn't be changed by the committee when they approached
and
that.
We actually have an email question about that from Justin, who is also a high school teacher. The piece of the proposed standard was explain how scientific and technological innovations, as well as new evidence, can challenge portions of or entire accepted theories and models, including but not limited to cell theory, atomic theory, theory of evolution, plate tectonic theory, germ theory of disease, and the Big Bang theory. What other challenges are there to any of these besides the theory of evolution?
Well, that original wording came in the last time standards were revised, which I think was in 2005. I don't remember exactly, but something like that. And the people who wrote the standards were under, well, as is typical of these committees, there were, you know, there were a range of voices being heard on the committees, and there were some creationists on the biology committee there. And as a compromise to try to get something that would protect evolution, members of the committee chose that wording as a way of kind of buffering evolution, not singling it out for special treatment, for special questioning, but including it in a whole range of other topics. Now, I personally think that that was not a good choice because, indeed, there is a problem with singling out evolution of all other scientific explanations and putting big flashing neon lights around it because it makes teachers less likely to teach it, obviously. But you don't actually protect evolution by putting it in a list of other scientific explanations because, as I think one of you, Lynn or Greg, was saying, Lynn, those other explanations or theories are, which one is the teacher going to pick, Right. I mean, it's the only one that the teacher is actually going to try to be expressing the weaknesses of course, is evolution. Greg, did you notice whether, I haven't looked at your new standards. I've been in bed since Wednesday, actually, with this really very bad virus, So I'll be very anxious to take a look at what the standards say. But did you notice, Greg, whether that wording was still there?
I think the wording is still there, and my secret hope is that this was left in. The committee was told they couldn't change this wording this year, and it was going to stick no matter what. But the last thing that happens to the standards is it goes through a process in the governor's office and the legislative committees, who can make changes at the last minute. And my secret hope is that the Secretary of Education's intention is to leave it in there until the very last, and then pull it out, because it doesn't make any sense to leave it in there. But leaving it there the whole time kind of inoculates the document against other kinds of arguments. Also, the committee this year did not include creationists. It was a well-formed committee,
good. And
I think they did a good job. And, you know, so I think, I don't know, we're not panicking in Minnesota at the time, at this moment.
That's good. Pleased to hear that. It's good. You know, we really, at NCSC, just so much appreciate when there is a good core of people in a state, like Greg and his colleagues in the Minnesota Citizens for Science group, that really monitor these things and take an interest and pay attention and do the work. I mean, there's actually some pretty funny folklore about NCSC and how we have the National Academy of Sciences at the end of the string, of course, and other silly things like that. But we just provide information and advice. I mean, it's the people like the Minnesota.
And you do a wonderful job, and I'm sorry to cut you off.
You do the work.
Greg, you have a really good way of asking the education question with teachers in the classroom. Why don't you just go ahead and take it away?
Okay, we had an interesting situation emerge in a conversation a few days ago here in Minnesota, where a hypothetical case, which usually means a real case that we're not using names for, arose, in which a teacher in a life science class is being asked by a parent to provide alternative curriculum for their child in biology, alternative to the evolution curriculum. And this is an untenured new teacher, and the administration was backing the parent, seemingly, or at least there was a thinking that the administration would likely back the parent. And a senior teacher kind of went in and sort of talked to people about this. And, you know, so this came up, and the conversation included a number of experienced people, legal experts, and so on. And, you know, the idea here, at least in Minnesota, the way this would work is you can't provide alternative curriculum for things that are on the standards.
There's no alternative assignment to long division.
Right. You can teach it a different way, and you can use. There is alternative curriculum, but it still has to address the standard. And that brings up the issue of what people actually do in classrooms and what role standards play. As you know, my wife is a teacher, and she loves the fact that standards exist because it saves her repeatedly again
and
again.
It's a great shield.
Yeah, could you talk about that and how that plays out in the classroom and classrooms across the country?
Standards can be used as a great shield. I remember a rather funny story from a California teacher a number of years ago. This is a teacher who's really squared away, and he's going to teach evolution. But, you know, teaching is a helping profession. I mean, you don't go into teaching because you want to fight with people, right? So you're going to try to be, you know, try to get along with folks and try to get along with parents. And anyway, so there's these three parents who showed up because they had heard that the teacher was going to be teaching evolution the next week, and they wanted to talk with him about that. And so he just pulled out the California Science Framework and said, well, you know, look here on these pages, those pages, you know, I've got to teach it. And they looked at the framework, and, you know, obviously their kid was going to be taught evolution. And so one of the parents says, well, but you don't have to teach it like you believe it. So the standards can be a very good shield for teachers. It can kind of take the pressure off the teacher. They can kick it upstairs, so to speak, as to why they have to teach it. I know it seems silly, but, you know, it at least gives the teacher a break.
One of the questions that came up in our discussion of standards here in Minnesota was how early in grade school should evolution be brought in the standards. There are people who are claiming that it should be brought in very early so students have some prior exposure to it. It currently, I think, comes in, and it really isn't significant in the standards in grade school. And other people who say that students aren't ready for it conceptually. What do you think about that?
Well, it depends on what you mean by evolution. If by evolution you mean the big idea of common ancestry, that's something that generally starts being taught in middle school, in junior high, and then intensified in high school. You don't tend to get very much of it in elementary school. I don't know. I think that students probably can grasp the idea of common ancestry. You can teach it through analogies with family trees and stuff like that. The idea that stuff gets passed on generation to generation. You know, I mean, you can communicate that to students. If by evolution you mean the processes or mechanisms, the idea of natural selection, adaptation, things like that, you can start laying down the groundwork for that in upper elementary school, and then intensify that in middle school and high school as well. The problem is that we don't have a very coherent curriculum in general in most states. You don't tend to build on what a student had in the previous year. It's almost as if every year is something brand new that you start in again. And this is one of the problems, I think, with science education. We need to spend a lot more time talking about how do we really bring students through a series of concepts so that they get the big picture. And that's not just about evolution. That's about science education in general.
Oh, thanks, Jeannie. And that probably brings to mind the caller who just left a message for us saying, why is it always evolution that seems to be under siege? Do you want to just say a few comments about that?
Well, it's because evolution is the scientific explanation that has the most repercussions, shall we say, for people's worldview and religious perspective. Evolution tells you that humans share kinship with all other creatures. For some, that's a very liberating and exciting idea and makes them feel one with nature, and it's empowering and so forth. For others, it's threatening. If your view is a human exceptionalism kind of view, that humans are separate from nature and special, especially if they are special to God, as in some Christian traditions, then evolution is going to be threatening to you.
Yeah, and this is the year of evolution, and you've been doing so much traveling and speaking just for that. And I want to remind folks that you have a revised book out that's been out for a while, but it's called Evolution versus Creationism. It's a very good book. I've very much enjoyed it.
Revised and expanded.
There you go. Thank you. And just one quick question. We're just about out of time. But with this new administration understanding and embracing science, I'm wondering, have you got an invitation to have dinner at the White House?
No, as a matter of fact, I haven't. And I think it's probably not going to be too likely either.
Oh, I think
as wonderful as that would be.
I think it might be in the cards here.
Well, the thing about the federal administration is that it really has almost nothing to do with curriculum. And ultimately, the evolution issue is a curriculum issue.
And we are just out of time. So I'd like to thank you, Jeannie Scott and Greg Layden, for being our guests on today's show. And thank Lynn Fellman for conducting the interview. I'd also like to thank all the Feringulistas whose questions we couldn't quite fit in.